But if we're honest, we will look into the mirror and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised.
The podcast.
What's Australia's role in the United Nations, and what are our ongoing obligations? My name is Cameron Riley. You're listening to the No Illusions podcast on the Podcast Network. And today, June 15th, my guest on the show is Virginia Balmain. Virginia is the president of the United Nations Association of Australia in Queensland and the vice president of the UNAA nationally in Australia. And I invited her to come on the show to help me understand a little bit about Australia's role, Australia's obligations, how well we're living up to those obligations, and to discuss some of the criticisms that I hear on a regular basis about the United Nations. Virginia Cameron Riley from the Podcast Network, how are you?
I'm good.
Oh, we have an interview scheduled for this morning.
What?
We have an interview scheduled for this morning.
Who with?
Myself.
You?
Oh, we had an email exchange. Exciting. Had an email exchange last week. Do you recall about the United Nations?
No, I don't.
In Australia?
Yes. No, don't recall that at all. But tell me all about it. or go ahead.
Well,
why do you want to interview me?
Well, we were looking for. I contacted you originally, looking for a contact at UNAA to do a show about Australia's role in the United Nations. You said you were available,
yes.
Lined it up for this morning.
Okay, fine.
Do you have time for it, or if I caught you in the middle
of
something?
What sort of time are you looking for, 2 hours or 10 hours?
Oh, half an hour, I was thinking.
That's fine. I can manage half an hour just for you because you're so good looking.
Do you need to prepare, or are you just going to, we can off the cuff?
I can only tell you what I can tell you.
Well, thank you, Virginia. Let's start off by introducing your role at the UNAA. I have your title down as the President of the United Nations Association of Australia, Queensland, and
that's
the Vice
correct.
President of the UNAA. Is that correct?
Yes, both of those are correct, yes.
Very good. And are you still involved in ActionAid?
ActionAid, that was AusCare.
AusCare, yes.
Used to be AusCare.
Yeah, that's right.
No, not really. Occasionally I get a newsletter from them, but not very often, so they're not really operating in, I don't think they're operating in any state except New South Wales.
Uh-huh, okay. Well, can you start off for us by explaining a little bit about the role of the UNAA?
Well, the United Nations Association is a civil organisation which was set up in 1945 to support the formation of the United Nations. And, of course, it started as a result of the tragedies of the Second World War with a view to never having a Third World War and it developing peace and security throughout the world. And the United Nations Association, as a civil organisation, endeavours to support those principles.
So when you say it's a civil association, is it made up of just citizens from around the country that want to be involved in discussing the role of the United Nations and Australia's involvement in it?
That's correct. I mean, obviously, usually it's people who believe in the United Nations and want to support what it's trying to do throughout the world. In our case, it's trying to raise the profile of the United Nations in Queensland and encourage people to support both our activities and major UN initiatives.
And how much involvement does the UN Association of Australia have with Australia's diplomatic representatives to the UN?
Well, that varies quite a lot. We assess various resolutions or policies that are developed by the United Nations and are or are not taken up by the Australian government. And so we address those issues. If they're things that aren't taken up, we try and persuade, through our numbers, I suppose, persuade the government to support the UN. Like, for instance, Australia doesn't have a Human Rights Act, and we think that that's an important part of our rights. And, of course, the UN does have a human Rights Declaration. So that's one thing where there's a bit of a difference between the country and the UN, and so we try wherever we can to, as I said, persuade the government to give more consideration to things of that nature.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because obviously one of the issues I wanted to talk to you about this morning was Australia's obligations as one of the member nations of the United Nations.
Yes.
I guess over the last 10 years that I can recall, we as a nation have come under fairly regular criticism from various United Nations bodies for our treatment of both the Indigenous Australians and also asylum seekers and refugees.
Yes.
And the response from successive governments to these criticisms seems to me to be that they just thumb their nose at them. What obligations do we have to the Human Rights Charter of the United Nations?
Well, first of all, you've got to differentiate between what you mean by we and the Australian government. We, meaning me and probably you, as citizens have, if you feel that way, kind of obligations to raise these matters with the Australian government. But it's the Australian government that is the member of the United Nations, not the people. I mean, although the Charter says we the people. If we can persuade the government to support the United Nations in some area that they're not, well, that's what we certainly try to do. But, you know, the government is the member, not us as people. So they follow their particular roles as the government in whichever party's in, whichever government's in, whether it's what the population wants or doesn't want. And I suppose they take some tax from a political point of view rather than a humane point of view.
So if the current Australian government is been receiving some criticism just recently over the last couple of weeks from the United Nations for some of its policies on asylum seekers.
Yes.
As a member nation, is the Australian government able to just ignore the criticisms from the United Nations?
No. They have, as you know, been working with the UNHCR, which is the United Nations Commission for Refugees, both here and in New York, and I imagine that the UNHCR is monitoring what they're doing and giving them criticism and support as they see fit. So the government just doesn't hold alone, so to speak. It does work with the UNHCR and other different arms of the United Nations, but that doesn't preclude them going in whatever direction they want to. And the philosophy of the United Nations, except for RTP, which has just come on board, is that each member state is sacrosanct in their own terms, that they can't persuade the governments. They might suggest and try to persuade, but they can't make governments change their tactics to follow the UN policies, or they can only try and persuade them. They can't make them do it, because each state member has the authority to look after their own state.
It's a sovereign
and
nation.
I just mentioned the RTP. Do you know about the RTP?
No, what is the RTP?
Okay, Responsibility to Protect.
Oh, yes.
And this has taken about 10 years to formulate, and it came out of the Rwanda genocide episode, where they didn't have the authority, and they don't have the authority, to go into countries to save or help the citizens. And they've applied this particular rule in Libya at the moment, where Gaddafi was actually killing his own people. So they applied this R2P in that instance. So that's been a little bit of change of the normal or usual United Nations policy of not going into countries. And so, you know, the UN will advise and will help and seek it, and Australia will seek advice from about refugees or about Indigenous people, but they don't have to take that advice.
So we have no obligation as a member state to work within the United Nations Human Rights Charter or the recommendations?
Oh, no, the obligation is there, but whether they exercise it or how they exercise it is each state or member's prerogative.
Right. We don't have our membership terminated if we don't abide by.
No. I suppose I think there have been a few terminations. I'm not aware of particular ones if countries are so disastrous, but we're not on that platform, thank goodness.
Well, there was a recent UN report urging Australia to repeal its policy of mandatory detention for asylum seekers, and
yeah.
Canberra's response was basically to say, well, we're rejecting your recommendations. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they running your own show is about. That's correct.
Does it lessen our credibility somewhat as a member of the United Nations complaining about the actions of other countries when we tend to ignore the UN's recommendations to us?
Well, I would think, of course, it does, but on the other hand, it would depend on how the other countries responded and how Australia responded to them. You know, it's a bit of a tit-for-tat thing, I think. But, for instance, we had the Indigenous Rapporteur who came to Australia to review the situation of Aboriginal people. Now, he couldn't come unless Australia invited him to come. The UN suggested he should come, and Australia did invite him. And he went around. We actually ran a conference at the time to try and raise awareness of the problems. And he made his report to the UN, which wasn't very flattering for Australia. And Australia didn't do anything. So then the UN said, "Oh, we'd like to send a health rapporteur out to have a look at the health of Indigenous people." And so he came out. Australia accepted that. The government accepted. He came out, went back, and made his report. Which, of course, wasn't too flattering. And then, as you know, Pillay's just been out, the Secretary-General of Human Rights has just been out. And if you sort of follow that pattern, the UN is limited in what it can do into or for other countries, but it can keep on tapping. Now, when those reports are tabled at the UN in New York, every country gets a copy, every country sees what Australia is or isn't doing, and so that to me would be a cause of embarrassment, especially three times over for the one problem. And, whether the government really takes cognizance of those reports and attempts to alleviate the situation, that's up to the government. We can do things as a civil organisation. We can highlight those reports. As I said, we ran a conference of about 300 people. So that sort of highlights or emphasises what's happened and what could happen. And it's a bit like the recent disaster with the cattle overseas in Indonesia. If you've got a big enough problem, eventually you'll get a change.
A challenge for the Australian people, Virginia, is if you take these issues seriously, is which government to vote for. I mean, the Howard government obviously didn't take these UN criticisms very seriously, didn't appear to. The Gillard government, again, doesn't seem to take them very seriously. Is there a political party in this country that does take the United Nations recommendations seriously?
Well, once you've nominated those two, you haven't got too many parties after that, have you, if you think about it?
Do the Greens take it seriously?
Well, it's also a matter of numbers. If you haven't even got the numbers to get into Parliament, well, then you can't achieve anything. If you haven't got the numbers to really run Parliament, as we're in a situation now, the Labor government's really teetering on the dependents getting behind them or not, as the case may be. So you haven't got a strong government in government, so to speak. And particularly when you've got an opposition, this is my opinion, who is really only interested in getting into government, not interested in Australia, Australians, or how Australia operates. They just want to get into government. Mm-hmm. And so they'll take whatever measures they can to try and achieve that purpose. So in this situation that we're in, it's very difficult to say that the government's can take responsibility for a lot of major issues, particularly when they haven't been taken up by previous political parties, when they're on such a knife edge of even being in government.
Well, but I don't.
Know, so the political play comes in.
I mean, I would at least like to see the Prime Minister or the Foreign Minister say, yes, we absolutely take this report seriously and we agree with the recommendations. Unfortunately, you know, we don't have a mandate, so we can't deliver on them, but at least, you know, call it as it is, if that's how they feel, rather than, you know, hide behind.
Well, have you ever asked Kevin Rudd what he feels as a foreign minister?
I have not had that opportunity, have you?
Oh, yeah, no harm in asking.
Well, we should try and get him on the show, and we will ask. Speaking of Mr. Rudd, I know that he's campaigning at the moment for Australia to have a seat on the Security Council come the 2013-14 elections. I mean, if, again, we're under criticism continually from the United Nations for our human rights record, do we deserve a seat on the Security Council?
Well, all I can say that for the size and population of Australia, it would appear to me that we've certainly lent a significant weight to supporting the United Nations since it was formed in 1945, and Australia took a part in that there. And there are a whole lot of other areas that Australia is involved in supporting, you know, the whaling issue and stuff like that. And I think Hilary Charlesworth is now the international judge on that process. You have to also realise that Australia actually has got a good running in comparison to many of the other countries in the United Nations. You know, our level of poverty is not anywhere near what they are in some countries, sadly. Level of education is the same, etc. So there are a lot of positive things that Australia has got going for it, and it does contribute to the United Nations. And those things, in some ways, not necessarily always, but some ways will balance off these three things that we're talking about: refugees, human rights, and Indigenous people. I'm not saying that that's any lesser concern, but that's what the situation is. It does balance it out.
Yeah. Oh, I take your point.
The other thing you've got to realise too is that when you say, you know, Australians who are really concerned about these issues, well, you want to draw up a list of them. There aren't that many. Australians are very complacent, in my opinion, and we're a very comfortable country, really. I mean, really, we're very, very well off. And Australians don't really, many Australians don't really take a great interest in what the United Nations is doing or what's happening overseas, unless one of their own is overseas and is caught in one of those issues.
Although you could argue that the 2007 federal election was in some ways, the swing to Labor during that election was a vote for Australia to take some of its international obligations more seriously, you know, particularly climate change and our involvement in military actions in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, Kevin Rudd's government was brought into power, you know, at least to some extent in order to address those. But the successive ALP governments don't seem to have succeeded dramatically in delivering on that promise.
Yes, I'd agree.
Well, let me ask you, just continuing on in terms of Australia's obligations, you know, there's an opinion that I hear a lot from people that the United Nations is a toothless tiger. That's the term that gets used a lot. There seems to be a fairly heavy amount of lack of respect for the United Nations, just when I'm having conversations with people here or in the United States. Why do you think that is? Why does the United Nations have this reputation for not being able to get much done?
Well, I would say it goes back to the fact that for years and years and years, history tells that people who are powerful like to go to war or to fight off civil wars or whatever. Power is in the hands of the person who holds the sword, so to speak. And that's not what, we don't do that here. So we don't have that power. Now, the United Nations doesn't have an army. It doesn't have a police force. It does have peacekeepers. It doesn't perpetuate the years and years and years of power that's been developed by people fighting or killing or whatever. And so the United Nations is not seen to be a monster, it's not seen to be an organisation that puts rules down, and it's not meant to either. And that's difficult for people to understand, I think.
When you say it doesn't put put rules down, the General Assembly does make recommendations and the Security Council does vote on, you know, in military involvement and issues, don't they?
So yes.
They have some level of authority.
Now, as you said, they make recommendations. Doesn't mean that the recommendations are followed through, like they've made recommendations to Australia, as we've already discussed. Doesn't mean the country follows through, because the United Nations doesn't have the power to make those things happen. They can only make recommendations, suggest things. For instance, the United Nations didn't agree with the Iraq war, but America went ahead and did it anyhow. So you could say, isn't it weak, because it was following a philosophy that was totally different to going to war.
Well, that brings up another issue I wanted to talk to you about. I mean, Australia participated in lending at least moral support to the United States for that invasion. What level of influence do you feel Australia has? We're obviously a small country, small population. We're small economically compared to many countries in the world. But we do have the ability, I feel, to lend some moral gravitas to these issues. And yet we don't seem to be using that when countries like the United States or Israel get involved.
Well, I think that goes back to what I said about Australia having influence right from the beginning of the United Nations. Australia does have influence in a lot of areas, and Australia's, produced outstanding and highly thought of foreign affairs ministers in the past, and ambassadors to the United Nations who have contributed in many, many ways. And Australia does do that. But also, I think it'd be true to say that if anybody doesn't know, the United States is the power behind the scene. That understanding. And Australia, sides with the United States in most instances for those reasons.
Mm. Do you think that's a weakness of the United Nations, the fact that the headquarters is still based in New York, and I think, is it 50% of the funding comes from the United States?
Well, the United States set it up. I mean, Roosevelt was the one that even coined the term United States. And, over 10 years, 7 years maybe, they had meetings towards the end of the Second World War of major country representatives, Churchill and so on, to discuss how they could set this thing up that wouldn't be a failure like the League of Nations. So they put a lot of energy and a lot of people involved in putting up the structure of the United Nations. And then the United Nations, again through Roosevelt, although sad that he died before the charter came into place, they actually financed, offered them a building. And if you parallel that sort of strong aim to get this thing set up so that we could have some sort of international organisation which would try and develop peace and security, if you compare that to where the United Nations is now and what it's doing in a non-military sense, it's huge. I mean, people may criticise the United Nations, but they only criticise it because they have really absolutely no idea what it does. And the United Nations is made up of individual people, like you or I, and whatever I might or you might bring to the table is your experience, your education, and that's what you can give to the, if you're in a position to give to the United Nations. And the same with all the High Commissioner, Secretary Generals, they all come from different countries, speak different languages, have different backgrounds, but they come together to meld to try and drive the United Nations forward. It's quite an interesting exercise, actually.
Oh, I'm sure it's a very complex operation. But getting back to the United States funding, I know there have been issues in the last few years in particular where the United States has been reluctant to meet its financial obligations to the UN to pay the bills, which has caused some concern. And obviously, you know, has some level of influence over UN decisions if it says, well, we're just going to shut you down by not paying the bills. Do you think this is something that needs to be resolved?
Well, it can't be resolved because if any country can take that attitude if they want to, if you think about it. Mm. Any country can do that. And, you know, as I said, America really was the one that set it up and worked with a whole lot of other countries to get the pattern of it set up, the General Assembly and Security Council, etc., so that it could operate. But, you know, that, not paying the bills, of course, does affect the operation dramatically. I mean, if you've got, they have 60,000 people they actually employ, apart from what everybody else does, and you're not getting the funds in and you can't pay them salaries, well, you know, it's a pretty strong effect, isn't it? But then on the other hand, when someone like Clinton comes in, he just pays all the bills off straight away. So it's really the political attitude of the country or the president or, in our case, the prime minister, if they decide to delay their dues or pay their dues on time. And, you know, an example of how important the United States is in this UN is the current situation in Libya, where 30 countries all agreed that's what they should do. And I think something like only 5 countries have put their hand forward. So you can have a lot of people agreeing with a situation but not actually helping. And often they'll have a special call in the United Nations for funds for some particular dramatic thing that's occurred. Everybody puts their hand up, they commit so much, but they don't actually pay it.
Yeah.
So you have a drama in the world going on. Countries have said, yes, they'll help, but they don't actually pay. So it's not easy at all.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like saying, I don't know whether you work or not, but it'd be like saying if your employer said, oh, well, we're not paying you for 6 months because we don't like the look of something or other, the boss or whatever, or don't like what he's doing, you know. So it's the same. I mean, that's a minor example, but that's what it is.
Yeah, and 60,000, I mean, that's basically the size of a Microsoft. They have about 60,000 employees. It's a massive operation. Let me ask you about the veto power that the permanent members have in the Security Council, Virginia. I understand a little bit about the history of why it was set up that way, but it seems to be these days that, you know, one of the permanent members is always vetoing an action because they're friends with some one rogue state or another. Between the United States, China, Russia and Germany, somebody's got, a rogue state that's a friend. Do you think that the veto system is reducing the effectiveness of the Security Council a bit?
I don't really know. I can't say that I followed. I mean, I understand what you said, but I haven't personally followed the vetoing particularly. And I certainly understand that there are some countries that support other countries in the world, and the other half of the Security Council support others. For whatever reason, I don't even understand all their reasons, and I don't think I ever will either. And it's really just a matter of how you can, you know, in some ways the veto probably saves a lot of things going on that might not should go on, whatever, I'm not sure. But if you didn't have the veto system, I think it just the General Assembly would probably just go willy-nilly. It's like a break. That's, as I said, a bit like a break, but I don't know enough about it to really comment more than that.
Shouldn't it be a democracy, though? Why should 5 countries be able to veto any activity? Why shouldn't it be a majority vote? Isn't that the idea of the United Nations, some sort of global democracy where the people of the world or their representative governments come together and decide how we live with more peace and harmony?
Well, democracy is a good word, isn't it? I suppose you could say Australia's a democratic country, but are our politics democracy or not?
I don't know. I personally
haven't read any United Nations charter or policies that talks about democracy, but it doesn't mean it's not there just because I haven't read it. Democracy is often only as strong as the strongest person or the one who can shout the most, I think.
That's a good point. Some U.S. politicians, such as Ron Paul, one of the perennial Republican presidential candidates, believe that the United States should resign from the United Nations. You know, I've got something from Ron Paul in front of me here that he wrote back in 2003. He says, we cannot allow U.S. national security to become a matter of international consensus. We don't need U.N. permission to go to war. Only Congress can declare war under the Constitution. The choice is very clear. We either follow the Constitution or submit to UN global governance. American national sovereignty cannot survive if we allow our domestic laws to be crafted by an international body. Is this a widely held opinion in political circles, do you think, that we should not submit, as he calls it, to United Nations?
Well, in the first place, I don't think the USA does submit to the United Nations. I think it more than contributes its knowledge, expertise and personnel to the United Nations. So I wouldn't agree with that. Well, it's nonsense to me about submitting to the United Nations. As I've already indicated to you, each country that's a member of the United Nations isn't governed by the United Nations. They can make recommendations, but the United States is no more governed by the UN than any other country. And the fact that it's all the countries together trying to make a collective decision, it would be foolish in my eyes if the United States wasn't among those countries.
But then we have, you know, the Iraq situation.
I think he might have changed his mind since 2003.
No, I've read stuff from him recently. It's still part of his platform. He's still calling for the United States to drop out of the United Nations.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I mean, he has some quite good ideas in other areas of policy, but this is one that concerns me. And one of the other criticisms that I hear from people about the United Nations, particularly from Americans, is that a rising number of the member states are from Islamic countries, and that before long it's going to be pro-Islamic voting blocs throughout the United Nations.
In other words, they're not like us. They're not like us, are they?
Not like us, so we have to be scared.
Well, I don't hear much of that here. Don't hear any of that here, actually.
The concern over the rise of the Islamic nations in the UN?
Yep, haven't heard any of that at all. I mean, I've read about it, but I haven't heard anybody talk about it.
And yet, you know, we continue to be a fairly pro-Israel nation and support the United States in defending Israel and the United Nations, despite the fact that for decades now, the General Assembly and the Security Council have continued to try and force Israel to go back to its 1967 borders, but we seem to vote with the United States against that.
Yes. I'd say... I think that more trying to force a peace solution rather than forcing Israel to go back forward or any direction, they've got to have a peace solution that they can all live with.
Well, that's been the recommendation, though, I think, out of the UN, is to return back to the 1967 borders and adopt a two-state solution. But,
I think that came out from Obama fairly recently, I think, in one of his visits overseas.
I think he mentioned that during his Egypt speech last year, but then again, hasn't delivered on it. He doesn't have their UN ambassador vote to enforce that in the Security Council.
Where are you from?
Australia.
Oh, so you're sitting on the tip of Australia with this phone call?
I'm in Brisbane.
Oh, you're in Brisbane, huh?
Yes, yes. Why do you ask?
So where are you from in Brisbane? I don't know, because I want to know, of course.
I grew up in Bundaberg, Virginia.
I know Bundaberg well.
Lived in Melbourne for 20 years and then moved back to Brisbane a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so what are you doing now?
Oh, I run a number of businesses, including a media company and a building company and an import business, a cigar company, lots of different things.
So have you joined the UN Global Compact?
I have not. What's the UN Global Compact, Virginia?
The UN Global Compact was something that the Kofi Annan started, and it was to try and encourage business and corporations to adopt within their companies the principles of the United Nations, 10 principles, the United Nations.
Excellent. Well, I'll have to look into that. I'd love to get our businesses involved in that.
Yeah, it doesn't cost you anything. Just have to fill in the form and send it off to Ban Ki-moon, and if you're good looking, he'll sign it.
Well, I definitely passed that one. So, Virginia, last question.
Hang on.
Yes.
Now, why are you doing this interview?
Well, I run a media company where I do lots of interviews on these sorts of issues. What are the big issues facing us economically, philosophically? How do we build a fairer, more peaceful, sustainable planet is one of the things that I'm interested in.
And so you also want to become a member of the United Nations Association, is that right?
Well, I would be very interested in knowing more about how to do that. That was going to be my last question. How do we, the people, get involved?
Well, if you give me an email, I'll send you some information.
What about for the listeners, Virginia? What should they do to get more involved?
What listeners?
Oh, the people that are going to be listening to this afterwards. This is a podcast.
So this is a radio broadcast?
A podcast.
Podcast.
Yeah. It'll be on the internet for people to listen to.
Okay. And so what was your name again? Who am I talking to?
Cameron Riley. I'll send
you. Have you got an email, Cameron?
Yeah. It's Cameron at Suave, suave.com.au.
And are you suave?
I try my best to be, Virginia.
And are you 5'5" or 5'6"?
6'2". Why do you ask?
Oh, 6'2". You sound like you're standing up. No, I don't think you are. I just want to know who I was talking to and why.
And I don't speak multiple languages, which is a question you asked me in an email last week. Unfortunately.
Yes.
So, Virginia, as I said, for the people listening to this, what can they do to become more
Cameron,
involved?
Cameron, how did you get hold of me?
I looked up the United Nations Association of Australia and found that
That's
you
fine.
Were the president of Queensland Division.
I had a law student that asked me very similar questions and anyhow. Right, go on with what you want to do. You've got about 5 minutes left.
Last question was, people listening to this, what can they do to get more involved in the UNAA?
Well, there are a couple of things. They could become a member of the association, obviously. They could become a non-financial member, which means that they get sent the monthly newsletter of what's going on, what's happening. They can, if they wish, attend. We have a monthly meeting every Wednesday evening. Anyone's welcome to come to the monthly meeting. And then we have various activities or events, like I've mentioned, conferences throughout the year that they'd be more than welcome to. And we really believe that if people are interested, we'd hope that they'd make some sort of contribution. I don't necessarily mean financial, that helps, but their own ideas, etc. Like you've talked to me with your ideas as well as asking me my ideas. And, you know, we need people to really want to be involved in what the UN is doing.
Lovely. Well, Virginia, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this morning. I've really enjoyed the chat.
Yes, so have I, Cameron, and good luck for the rest of the day.
Thank you. And just before we go, when I've put this online, I'll send you an email with a link to it as well, so you can listen to it or send it out to your members in a newsletter or do whatever you wish.
Okay. Thanks, Cameron.
Thanks, Virginia. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Well, there you have it. A little bit disjointed, but we got there in the end. Hope you enjoyed that show. Interested to get feedback in the comment line or on Twitter. Let me know what you think about the United Nations, the country that you live in and its involvement in the United Nations. What is its track record like? Do you think your country is fulfilling its obligations as a member state to the best of its ability? Is it just paying lip service when it's when there are the recommendations that involve the country that you're a part of? What can you do in your country to try and ensure that your government abides by its obligations to the United Nations? I don't claim to be an expert on any of these things, but you know, I'm interested in learning more about what we, the citizens, can do to make the United Nations a more successful body, I guess, in international affairs. Thanks for listening. This is Cameron out. We'll be back soon with more shows. Cheers.
We will look into the mirror and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised.